From Boca Raton, Florida, this is Behind the Bima. On this episode, the rabbis are joined by Eli Pillay, owner and publisher of Mishpacha magazine. Eli discusses how he got his start in publishing, shares his thoughts on the Haredi world, and explains Mishpacha's position on publishing women's faces. Plus, the rules for WhatsApp voice notes, and who's celebrating a birthday. All this and more, Behind the Bima.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wednesday night, 9 p.m. You know what that means. I'm Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, joined by my dear colleagues and friends, Rabbi Philip Moskowitz and Rabbi Josh Brody. And we are here to take you
behind the Bima.
Behind the Bima. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. What promises to be another fantastic show. We got great topics that we're going to cover, things that are on our mind. Let's hear about how Moshe Moskowitz's bar mitzvah went. In fact, somebody suggested to me tonight, we have a very special guest coming on, very excited to learn about his background, his work. There's a big question that a lot of people have. They want us to ask him. So someone suggested to me, why don't you bring Moshe Moskowitz back on to ask that question? He is the best person.
Question of the week.
To forward that question. So Moshe Moskowitz continues to be a big hit, a legend on Behind the Bima. But first, let's talk about and acknowledge our amazing sponsor for tonight. I want to thank our sponsors, Esther and Rabbi Seth Grossman, former residents of Boca and BRS, still dear friends to so many of us, who sponsored tonight in honor of Shira's amazing sister, Esther's amazing sister, Shira Gabriella Zaltzman, who and her Judaica Fine Arts Gallery. This is the second week in a row we have a sponsorship in honor of an artist in Israel. Many of us, most of us, are not able to travel to Israel at this time. We desperately wish we could be there, but we have the ability wherever we are to support artists, support brothers and sisters in Israel and what they're doing. Shira Gabriella lives in Israel.
She's a great, great artist.
Artwork. I wish I could present and bring on some of that original artwork, but if you want to check it out, go to shiragabriella.com. Instagram, Shira Gabriella. It's 1L, Shira Gabriella on Instagram. And listeners, tonight, if you go on and order something, if you mention Behind the Bima, 10% discount. 10% discount for Behind the Bima.
Wow.
That is a special Behind the Bima opportunity. So
Hanukkah's coming up. Hanukkah's coming up, everybody.
Hanukkah is coming up. Opportunity to celebrate an artist in Israel who does outstanding artwork. Don't do it because it's chesed or tzedakah. Do it because it's great artwork.
And don't forget, this is not an artist just from Israel. This is an artist that grew up in Elizabeth. So, I mean, this is a big deal.
Mention that, Rabbi Brody. First of all, let me give you the correct website. It's etsyetsy.com/shop/Shira Gabriella. It's on the screen. You could check it out. But the reason that that's interesting, Rabbi Brody, who's from Elizabeth, New Jersey, is because Seth and Esther also have another deal tonight, a trivia question.
Ooh.
Where if you buy one piece of artwork, you could get the second piece for 50% off. If you get this trivia answer correct, my parents, my mother in particular, is ineligible to enter into this trivia question. So maybe Rabbi Brody or maybe Rabbi Brody's mom, who used to get mentioned every single episode, hasn't been mentioned in a while.
Now I'm going to hear about it from my mother.
This is season 2, episode 11, and we haven't heard about Mrs. Brody in a while. But the trivia question is the following. How far back does my family go with Shira Gabriella's family? How many generations back? How far back? Who were they, the first to have met and to form a relationship? And what year, around what year, was that? That is a trivia question. Whoever comes closest to answering that question tonight.
Am I eligible?
50% off on the second piece that they buy, the artwork. It's really fantastic. Check her out on Instagram, Shira Gabriella. Yeah, you're eligible. Go for it.
I'm going to say.
I know you. I know there's this Abramov. I don't know who that is, but I always hear you talking about them and something about like fourth or fifth.
Abramov.
Yeah, his name is Moskoshinsky. That's right.
He used to play the clarinet.
Very close. Very close. Moshka Berg. Okay. Clearly, Rabbi Moskowitz is not the winner. So feel free to say comments on.
I'm going to say four. I'm going four. I know it's at least three, but I'm going to push it one beyond.
Okay. Who is it?
I'm going to say it's going back to the Prales, even before Rabbi Teitz.
Okay, very good.
Because I'm just telling you, the Prales lived right next door to your grandparents, the Abovs.
Okay.
I'm saying there's
getting somewhere now. You can reach out to any of us right now privately. You can reach out in any of the comments on any of the platforms you're listening to. And whoever comes closest, Rabbi Brody gave you a head start. Whoever comes closest to knowing how far back my family goes, how many generations, who the people were, and what year, will get 50% off the second piece of outrageous artwork they order from Shira Gabriella Saltzman. Special thank you to Seth and to Esther. Boys, what's going on? What is new?
Well, we have a very special episode of Behind the Bima tonight. Robbie Brody, do you want to tell people what December 9th is on the calendar and what we're celebrating today?
What happened to Robbie Moskowitz?
He's going to go. It's going to be a solo show in a second.
Robbie Moskowitz is forgetting that I have the editorial ability to remove people from the show and add them back on.
I'll just say one of us has a birthday today.
And it's not me.
And it's not me.
Well, it's also because one of my major pet peeves in life, if anyone knows me, is not to celebrate or mark Gregorian birthdays. It's a pet peeve because we're Jews. We operate and live by the Jewish calendar. We don't mark Pesach by what it was that year. We don't mark. I've yet to meet a Jew who marks a Yahrzeit. Maybe they also acknowledge and honor the English date, but they say Kaddish and light a candle on the Hebrew date. So why is it in so many aspects and areas of life we recognize our Jewish uniquely Hebrew calendar, and yet it comes to birthdays and anniversaries, and the average even Orthodox Jew, and I'm not going to embarrass anybody tonight, online or offline, but the average even Orthodox Jew has no idea when their own Hebrew birthday, couples often don't know their own Hebrew anniversary, and that's the day that matters. That's the day that we revisit on the calendar, that cycle, that energy of why we're here, why that marriage matters, and why we're here. So
you are 100% right, today. Which is why everyone on Shabbos morning should come over to Rabbi Goldberg and wish him a happy Hebrew birthday.
You're absolutely killing me. I take my birthday off social media. I take it out of the Shul Weekly. I take it out of everywhere, not because I'm shy and bad.
And we bring it back in.
I'm not one of those people who have a hang up about a birthday and I'm willing to celebrate it. I'm glad to be able to celebrate it. But I don't want to put the pressure on others to be able to say happy birthday and answer a lot of texts. So I appreciate all the love and thank you very much. I will tell you this about birthdays. I struggled with birthdays when I turned 40. I loved being in my 30s. I thought it was a great decade building a family and building a career and you know trying to build myself as an Eved Hashem. And I loved being in my 30s. And turning 40, it's great, but I wasn't excited about turning 40. I'm no longer in my early 40s. If a person merits to live to 90, I'm now on the back nine of life. Turn that corner. Rabbi Brody will in a couple of weeks as well.
And very soon.
So I used to be a little bit sad about birthdays, not want the attention, not want the birthday. It just means you're a year closer to when it's all going to come to an end. But very significantly, and I won't mention this, Rabbi Moskowitz, I'll leave it to you if you want to, but there are people who've struggled with illness, and there are dear close friends of ours who left this world extraordinarily young, way too soon. Dear, dear friends that we miss terribly. And right. I remember when particularly our dear friend Brian passed away, I thought to myself, aside from his just being the most positive and optimistic and happy and good person who saw the best in everything and everyone and always felt connected to Hashem, I remember saying to myself, how could I ever, ever, ever say anything negative of a birthday again? If you merit to be alive for another year, just be grateful and celebrate. Right. Don't be that Debbie Downer. Don't be that negative person about birthdays. So anyway, I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be alive.
Happy birthday.
I definitely have my eye on that back nine and thinking about what that means in the second half. And you should only be lucky enough and merit another nine holes and a back nine of life.
But, amen.
You
know,
what does that mean when you turn the corner? You'll get there soon when you start to see the clubhouse off in the way distance. But it gets you thinking about who you are, what you are, what you want to accomplish, what you want to leave the world. And so those are some of my thoughts. Thank you for the sentiment. It's not my birthday. It's coming up soon, but I appreciate it.
I'll just say that your assistant sent around today a little card to the staff. And I was so wondering, it's like bothering me because everyone was writing these like little short things like, hey, happy birthday, you know, from so-and-so and happy birthday. It's like, come on, this guy's, you know, it's a big deal. Let's say a little something to the guy. So it's one of these electronic birthday cards. I spent, you know, some time putting some thought into it, wrote a couple sentences. And then your assistant texts me about an hour later. She's like, it's not for him. It's for someone else in the office.
That's hilarious. Well, I want to take a moment to introduce our special guest is going to be coming on momentarily. And I want to take a moment, even before he gets here, for those who don't know who he is and why it's so significant. We're grateful that Eli Pali has woken up in the middle of the night in Israel.
Wow.
It's currently 4:09 a.m. in Israel. And yet he so graciously and generously has woken up early to be with us. Part of a testament to who he is it's not so early for him because he wakes up every day to Daven Vasikin at sunrise, which in Israel is very early. He's an alumnus of Chevron Yeshiva. He is the owner of Mishpacha Media Group, the publisher of Mishpacha Weekly Magazine, both in Israel and in America. He's a businessman, a social activist. He's the chairman of his family foundation. and a member of the Jewish Funders Network, and he's involved in several philanthropic organizations. Wow. And so much to talk to him about that. What informs his Jewish philanthropy? And as a successful businessman, how did he decide to turn his talents to tzedakah and to who should get it, where should give, and what difference he wants to make in this world? Mishpacha is a magazine that is in countless homes and stores. We're familiar with it. It's exploded. We'll learn about its circulation and some controversy around it, controversy from both directions. A segment of the community who find it controversial for what's not in it, and a segment of the community in another direction who find it controversial for what is in it, and how he takes that heat and what he does with that. So very, very excited to be able to welcome him on. And without any further ado, it is a great pleasure and a great honor to be able to welcome Eli. Eli, thank you so much for being with us this morning in Israel, tonight here in America. You look very alert and awake for somebody who is up in the middle of the night.
Hi, good evening and good morning, Vayas.
Good evening and good morning. Thank you so, so much for being with us. So, you know, before we dive right in, as we give you the chance to wake up with us, tell us, you're a successful businessman, you're a philanthropist, you're a visionary who created a magazine that has explosive circulation in Israel, in America. You launched the first and probably the only Haredi think tank, the Haredi Institute for Public Affairs. There's so much to talk to you about, but first tell our audience and tell us about your own background. What brought you to this point? Were you always on the trajectory to be a businessman? Did you always want to originate and publish a magazine? Have you ever thought that you'd be somebody who'd run a think tank? Tell us about your own background and who were the influential personalities in your own upbringing that brought you to who you are today?
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, rabbis. So I'll start to introduce myself. I'm 56 years old. I was born in Jerusalem 56 years ago. My family from my father's side came to Eretz Israel in 1925 from Russia, Lithuania, to establish the yeshiva in the city of Hebron, the Slobodka Yeshiva, which became later one of the leading yeshivas in Eretz Israel. So my history as a family, that we made Aliyah in Eretz Israel many years before the establishing of the State of Israel to establish Torah in Eretz Israel. So I grew up in this family. My father was very, very much involved in Askanos. Also, by the way, with American Askanim, he started the American Pe'ilim on the 50s to help the new Olim who came from the Eastern, the Sephardi world, to bring them to Yeshivot. So he was very active over the years in many areas. I learned also in Hebron Yeshiva. By the way, my son was a fifth generation in the Hebron Yeshiva.
Wow.
So this is, on one hand, my connection to try to bring Torah in Eretz Israel from my family roots. And the story, how did I get into business and specifically into this kind of business was also connected to my learning in Yeshiva. I was learning in Yeshiva. And after I got married, I wanted to continue to learn in Yeshiva. But that days, the Hebron Yeshiva didn't have a koilel. Koilel is for married people who wants to continue to learn in Yeshiva. So I asked the principal, can I stay in Yeshiva? Because I love the Yeshiva. I would like to continue. This is my biggest love, to learn Torah and to learn specifically in Yeshiva. And they said, listen, you can stay, but we are not paying for people who want to stay in Yeshiva. I said, I don't care. I want to stay and learn in Yeshiva. So I stood and learned. And very few months later, I was my wife just started in college. She started to learn psychology. And I was offered to become the distributor of Mishpacha magazine. Mishpacha at that days was a monthly publication, a very small monthly publication. And my brother came to me and said, listen, I was offered this job. It's not really interesting. It's just a monthly publication, 2-3 days a month of work. But maybe for you as a side job, something that you might be interested in. And I said, yes, for sure. And
let me interrupt you for 1 second. What made him think that you'd make a good editor? What in your Hebron background? Do you edit the Torah Journal of Hebron? Were you editing Mamorim and Divrei Torah? What made him think that you'd be cut out for that job?
Nothing. That's why I wasn't offered to be an editor. I was offered to be a distributor to carry the magazine.
Okay.
A distributor, very simple, the basic level of working for the publication. I had an old car, and once a month I was going to the printer to pick up the magazines and then to go to the stores. But that allowed me to sit and learn and support myself without getting support from Yeshiva. And I was very happy with this job because that allowed me to stay and learn Makom Shel Ivoch Hafetz, the place I love to learn, the way I love to learn. And it really didn't bother me because it took me like a day and a half, 2 days of intensive work. And the rest of the months I was free to continue to do my learning. Just later on, my father was asked to invest in this business. And he said, you know what? Looks like a small, nice business. If some my son works there, so maybe it will be something interesting. So what I'm trying to say, that this is another way of the Ashgacha to bring you into something that later became so significant in my life. And also, I think, in the Haredi Jewry. But the way I got into it, again, was my big love of learning Torah and Yeshiva. To answer your question, what made me to turn from becoming a very a successful business into the very active in the askonus or I don't know, to help the Haredi people. So it was very natural because Mishpacha over the years became a vehicle of social activism, meaning besides being a very successful business, as you know, and I think people who knows Mishpacha, what made Mishpacha very unique was that it was a very unusual style in publications in Israel, because most of the Haredi publications in Israel, to those of you who is not aware, are very political oriented, meaning every party in Israel has their own publication. The Hasidim have Hamudia, and the Litvish people have Yated Ne'eman, and some Hasidish, each of them have their own publication. And when I enter into this business, I came very naive without any agenda. And the agenda was the way I grew up in my family is really to serve the community, to be a very sensitive to challenges in the society. And all of a sudden, that also became the formula of becoming a very successful business, because that was very different from the regular Haredi journalism in Israel when we entered into this business.
The truth is, it's an outstanding story, which I wish we had more time to unpack now, how you went from being a delivery person, a delivery boy. You went from throwing newspapers in the back of a car to being the owner, publisher, editor, and for growing it. And there's really an enormous story that we'd love to learn more about, how one climbs that ladder and how, if a person has ambition and aspiration, they can achieve that. But I want to, and maybe we'll come back to that if we have time, you give us the time. But I want to talk a little bit more about Mishpacha, obviously. Mishpacha is a tremendous magazine. It's growing. It's sold all over. I've seen it in homes of people who identify as Haredi, Tzioni, Modern Orthodox, across the entire spectrum. It's sold in stores across the Orthodox spectrum. The Mishpacha Publishing Group was founded, as you were saying, 1984. The English Mishpacha launched in 2004. I'd love to learn more about the circulation. How many are printed each week in Israel, in America, how widely it's circulated? Can you get it in America if you live anywhere? Obviously, if you live in heavily Jewishly populated neighborhoods, you can. If you live in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and you want to read Mishpacha, how do you get your copy?
So based on polls that we have in Israel, Mishpacha is the leading publication over the last, I think, 15 years at least. And every third family is having Mishpacha on a weekly basis. Wow. I think two-thirds of them are people who are buying Mishpacha, and another third of people who are getting Mishpacha for some friend or relative. This is why, again, of the uniqueness of Mishpacha, that it's like a community publication that people are passing over. Same in America. We don't have in America, we have less good statistics, but we're talking about approximately 250,000 readers on a weekly basis.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's huge. Keep
in mind, interestingly enough, the COVID-19, I know that it's affected many businesses in many ways, including, I think, almost every publication. But we find a very interesting phenomenon, which the COVID, maybe I have an explanation why, increases dramatically the circulation of the publication, both in Israel and in America. I think part of the explanation is that people are staying less by each other for Shabbat, so they need their own copy. But I believe also that Mishpacha provide some kind of a sense of secure and comfortable in the times that people feel less secure. That's my understanding. I spoke to people about it. Just yesterday, I met with someone who told me, listen, I was never buying magazines into my home. And since the COVID-19, I find that we need something for the family to be around the table. So that's also something that makes us feel very special in terms of serving the community. The Mishpacha is inspiring the society. And also in times of challenges, people feel that they have a place to go, which is the publication. We are doing our best effort to try to get to anyone who needs to get the publication, even if it's far. At the beginning of the COVID-19, we started a digital magazine just to help people who are not able to get the magazine because of some delivery difficulties and etc. to be able to get it for free, just to continue to serve the people again, because we really understood how much Mishpacha, what's Mishpacha is so meaningful to people. So we said, you know, let's leave aside the business for a moment and see that we will be able to continue to give people what they need, what they're looking for.
It's really is an extraordinary. I know in my house, they wrestle over their copy of Mishpacha because the articles are diverse, from human interest stories and politics and inspirational biographies of great Gedolim. I want to hone in a little bit, and with your permission, I want to push a little bit on some of the buttons that have been pushed both from the right and the left on Mishpacha. I don't want to harp on it because it's not the nature of our show. We're not a controversial show. We're trying to offer inspiration, not controversy. But on the other hand, you know, I do, and we would be remiss if we didn't bring it up in both directions. And I want our audience to appreciate something I've come to learn both as a consumer of Mishpacha and someone who's been privileged to write several times in Mishpacha, and as hearing from the Amcha out there about Mishpacha, that Mishpacha plays a role which people should really appreciate. It's a Haredi publication, and it identifies with the Haredi community, but it does several significant things that are unusual or maybe refreshing and pushing some of the boundaries in the Haredi community. And in fact, there have been articles and studies that have shown or have attributed to Mishpacha an increase in Haredim joining Israeli's army, to Mishpacha, mental health awareness, mental health services among Orthodox population, because Mishpacha has brought some of these issues to light. Mishpacha is unabashedly featured the full gamut, as you said, with an Orthodoxy from Hasidim and Yeshivish and Sephardic and modern Orthodox. I know it was a very proud moment for me when my Rebbe, Rav Schechter, was on the cover of Mishpacha, and there was a feature article that referred to him as one of the Gedolim, as a major posek, and there were no apologetics, and it didn't dumb down any of the titles for him. And I thought that was a really, really great and breakthrough moment in a time in which people are very dug in, and you are not. And I know you've taken heat for that, and I want to come back to that in a moment, because I think it's something that we should celebrate, even or especially those not in the Haredi community, that a Haredi publication has helped advance Haredim joining the army, has helped advance mental health awareness and physical health awareness, that it's willing to embrace Achdus and feature diverse gamut of Jewish leaders to expose the readership, 250,000 subscribers a week in America, to that full gamut. And out of that 250,000, they're not all from Teaneck and Boca and Los Angeles or the five towns. They're in many communities who they had never heard of or don't know or had negative impressions of people like Rav Schechter. So I think that part of the work is really extraordinary, and it deserves to be acknowledged. It deserves to be praised, and it should be appreciated for what it's done. You know, Mishpacha also notably in America has a woman, correct me if I'm wrong, from what I understand, who's the managing editor, has countless women who are contributing authors to it. Mishpacha Online features pictures of women. But Ellie, you know what I'm building to, of course, a question on the minds of many, which is the policy. So I know that in Israel, you've taken significant heat from more extreme voices in the Haredi world for the fact that you feature such diverse leadership in the Torah world. You've taken heat from the right. A great Gadol at one point said not great things about Mishpacha, while other Gedolim, of course, came to Mishpacha's defense. On the other hand, there's a segment of the community here in America, particularly, who are disturbed by a policy of not featuring women's faces, the impact that has in advertisements, the impact of erasing women's faces from their own articles or features about them, what that means and what that bodes, or people confusing that for being a new halachic standard or a standard that everyone should follow. And, you know, I personally disagree with it. I think it's a terrible mistake. It's a gross miscalculation. But I'd be remiss if I didn't give you a chance to address it and share a little bit about that policy. And again, as I said, I don't want to harp on it because it's not a controversial show. But as you address that, I'm curious personally for you, what's harder, taking the heat from the right for being so diverse and open, or taking the heat from other segments of the community for being so closed that you don't feature these pictures?
Thank you so much for bringing this issue. It's a challenge. By the way, we are not afraid from questions because this is the way we are learning Torah. This is the way that to create a dialogue. And especially, I think this is a very important issue that I would love to bring and discuss. It's complicated, but it's sensitive and important enough that I really appreciate the opportunity to share it with you and hopefully to explain a little bit where we're coming from. So I want to start by your last note saying that which part of the criticism we can live better with the right wing people who are very extreme and will criticize us for having any image of something that can be considered as a woman, or to the people who really bothers. And I must tell you that in the past few years, we really find this issue a serious issue that we discuss again and again. And mainly, you know, I met with a very active lady that came over to me, and she said, "Listen, we are we are the people who are working in outreach, very bothered, and it's hard for us to explain to people the fact that a Haredi, a mainstream Haredi publication, is really eliminating women." And I told her, "Listen, this is the first time I hear an argument that really makes me feel that we need to do something about it. Because as long as people are coming to me and say, 'Listen, we will boycott Mishpacha,' there is some Facebook group who are trying, or the opposite. I was got offer that they are trying to bring together 5,000 people to sign subscribers of Mishpacha if Mishpacha will start to put pictures of women. And by the way, I just want to correct you. We don't have 250,000 subscribers. We are talking about around 40, between 40 to 50,000. But I said about readership, meaning people in the family.
Exposure.
I just want to be accurate. So when I spoke to, it was Allison, what's her name?
Joseph.
Allison from Jew in the City. What's her name?
Allison Joseph.
So she was the one, she asked to meet with Miss Wooly Besser, set up the meeting. And when she brought this issue, I said, "Listen, as long as you are talking about business, it's a very easy decision for me. We're having hundreds of thousands of readers that some of them, I'm not saying that the majority, but are talking about significant segments, especially Hasidish, that for them, a publication who is running with pictures of women, this is something that they will have a problem to bring home." So I said, as long as this is a business decision, it's very easy. But we're not just about business here. We're talking about issues. And Mishpacha is someone who represents the Haredi voice and the Haredi Jewry as to face this challenge and to try to understand how this is affecting or creating an image about Haredi people. So I want to tell you a story, a very interesting story. We really find ourselves dealing with this issue when Hillary Clinton was running for presidential.
Right.
By the way, we did an interview with Donald Trump, and we were offering Hillary to interview her, and she said yes, but with only condition with my picture on the cover. Mm. This is what her people said. They were very sensitive because 2 years before, 3 years before, when Osama bin Laden was killed, so there was a famous picture was published in Haredi publication that they were sitting by the president and they erased the picture of Hillary. So she was very sensitive. And as you understand, we couldn't accept it. So we couldn't put her picture in the magazines, and we gave up about the interview. When the election, you know, we saw the polls that the election started to be, came to an end. So we knew that there was a big chance. By the way, at that time, it was the biggest chance that Hillary is going to win and she's going to be the president. And we start to ask Gdoile Torah, what should we do? What was the question? The question was, we all understand that it's one decision, you know, you can make a business decision or any other decision that you can decide how to, skip the need to put pictures because there is some sensitivity. But when it comes to a president, everyone understands that as a prominent publication, you can't run a publication and hurt the president.
Is that true only for a president? What about a vice president?
Let's start with the president. Our rabbinical board started to discuss with the Gedolim. I'm talking about the leading Gedolim in America, as we usually do when we have a real serious issue. And the first reaction was for more than two of the big rabbinim. We asked halachically, can we put a picture of Hillary? And they said, who told you till today that you can't put the pictures of women? Kilo, you're coming to ask us halachically, is that allowed to put a picture? Did you ever ask halachically that you can't? That was the first reaction. Then we were told that it's very clearly, Upnei Shlom Malchus, the respect of the president, for sure, if Hillary will be elected, we will have to put a picture of women. And I must admit, I was so happy to get this psak, because for many years, I didn't feel comfortable with this policy, meaning we are choosing the policy. When I started the Mishpacha publication in 2004, my dream was, I said, you know, in Israel, there is some Hasidish, some extreme people, so we have more problem. But at least in the English publication, we will be able to put, at least in the women magazine, pictures of in the modest way. And very, very soon, when I started to talk to people, to meet with people, to learn the market, I was told, no way. If you want to be a mainstream publication, don't even try to do it. And I must admit, I was very disappointed, because I was sure that we can come to some compromise in this. So, and I'll explain soon why it's important for us to take into consideration, because if I'm saying that this is something that we don't feel comfortable with, why we're doing it, and I'll get to this immediately. But the point was that, so when we were told by the Rabbonim that we should do it, I was so happy. I said, okay, so finally we can find a way that, you know, following the instructions of a Rabbonim and make something more reasonable in the way that we're dealing with this issue and addressing the challenges that we were asked by the people who are dealing with outreach. So the week before the election, we just taste the water. We put a shadow of Hillary and Trump. I don't know if you remember.
I remember, you know, absolutely.
Like, to see how it goes. And I must say, yes, we got some phone calls from angry subscribers, a few Hasidim. We got maybe very few people who canceled the subscription. But in general, it was accepted very well. And I was very happy to see that, you know, it's okay. We were attacked by one of the leading publications. I don't want to mention the name. One of the leading publications attacked us, not in their English edition, in their Hebrew edition, and as Israel, saying, how dare Mishpacha to break the rules? And because Mishpacha is a leading publication, so now everybody will have to follow. So they used their Hebrew publication in Israel to attack Mishpacha, that we are now Poretz Gadel. Okay, the day of the election, I was in New York at that day. It was Tuesday. And we had a conference called the editors and the rabbinical board talking about how, you know, we save a special edition for the election, because usually we are closing the magazine on Monday. So we closed the magazine and we did a special supplement. And we discussed how we should feature the winning president at that night, which was clear it's going to be Hillary. And okay, so we discussed it, how we should do it in a modest way, you know, not to put like a big picture with the crowd, never mind. At the end of the conversation, I told my people, Raboisai, we have 8 more hours to daven, maybe we won't have to do it. And as you see, the miracle happened. Now seriously, what's the issue? The main issue, that's what I explained to Allison when we spoke. I said, listen, I totally agree that the issue, how a publication should deal with the issue of putting images of women, is something that we, Mishpacha, as a leading publication, have to address. No question about it. But I said, Mishpacha have a role besides just the business. Mishpacha is, as you mentioned, is very influential, is someone who is really touching challenges in the Haredi society. And we should choose our flags, which one we feel is more important, to get to as much people as possible to accept Mishpacha as their publication, something they can be identified with, and trying to do in a sensitive way, for sure, not to do it in a humiliating way, not to erase picture. We had a story, by the way, that in one article in the Hebrew publication, we find out that the graphic artist erased a picture of a woman, and we were very upset. The rule is that you don't want to put a picture, try to find a creative way to put an image, but never erase a picture. But what I'm trying to say is, yes, we understand that on one hand, we need to try to find a better way to deal with the issue of putting the pictures of women. On the other hand, we want, because of our role, because we want to be accepted in the society as someone that people will take it as their own publication. And right. Once we have significant segments, I'm not saying it's majority. I think it's something between 10 to 20% of our readership. But we want everybody, as you said, we Mishpacha see ourselves as a publication that wants to unite it and to bring everybody around the table. So we felt that this is not the right flag to raise, but that make us a decision to start in the online edition to try to start to bring the pictures of women, because we feel that this is a serious issue. At least in the online version, we feel that this is a way that we can try to bring some kind of solution.
Let me push back a little bit. And again, we don't want to harp on this. There's so much more to talk mm-hmm. about and learn from you. First of all, I want to summarize what you're saying, because I want to make sure that it's clear to me and to those who are listening is, you know, there are many who will cynically or accurately say it's a business decision. An enormous segment of those who are paying, taking out ads, are part of a community who embrace that policy, and Mishpacha will lose subscribers, they'll lose advertisers. So it's a business decision. And by the way, that might be even a fair business decision to make. What you're saying is it's not a business decision.
No.
What you're saying is that Mishpacha is a vehicle for social activism. And if somebody's objectively looking, they would see that Mishpacha's penetrating into the community and making a difference. And the cost of being able to be in those living rooms so that it's being read and to make that difference within the more extreme parts of the Haredi community, so they'll read and learn about mental health or the Israeli army or Rav Schechter or Arthas. That's the cost of entry. So yeah. I guess my pushback to you is a couplefold. Number one, Arts Girl hasn't felt it's had to do that. Arts mm-hmm. Girl publishes biographies of Gedolei Yisrael, the Rav Yoshev biography and others that have pictures in women. So, you know, if the Gedolei Yisrael have told Mishpacha, there's no halacha, who told you that you have to do this? And other Haredi publications, maybe among the most famous, Art Scroll, have women, then maybe that's a cost that's worth doing. Maybe if someone is so extreme that they're embracing a policy that Gedolim don't think is necessary, even if it means that they won't read Mishpacha, maybe that's more important than the cost in the other direction, which is the women who are upset or turned off. That's number one. But number two is I want to make a suggestion. I hope nobody's offended. I've never opened up Family First. I like to read Mishpacha cover to cover with a bowl of cholent on Friday night. Both of them are delicious. So the writing is sophisticated. It's excellent. It's diverse. I really enjoy it. Not only reading my own articles, but others as well. So it's excellent. It's excellent. But my question is this. Just like sometimes I, as a man, am alerted to a woman's, you know, you get a link and it says, this is for women only, because it's women singing or the imagery and it's for women. Why not have the main publication follow that policy so it can get into the segment or the homes that you want, and have Family First be more open on this policy? Those who have no problem looking at pictures, men or women, can continue to read it. Those who don't, won't. But by having at least that presence in policy, you'll make it clear that this isn't an absolute halacha, that no one's trying to erase a segment of the community, that advertisements to women from women can have faces in there. And again, it won't satisfy everyone. It may not satisfy many, but I think it'd be a major step in that direction to say that there's not a wholesale elimination and erasure of women from the whole publication, all of the supplements. Let Family First, which again, I might be getting in a lot of trouble right now by suggesting that it's mostly...
Hey, that's my wife's favorite. You better watch out.
Let it have women's pictures. And those who have no problem with it, I would have no problem reading it with women's pictures, will read it. Just like I had no problem reading Rav Yosha's biography from Art Scroll. Those who do have a problem won't read it and will only read, or maybe you could subscribe if you're worried for it coming into your home. You can get just the main magazine, or you can get the magazine with Family First that has pictures of women, and offer a dual subscription opportunity so that you can continue to penetrate the homes of that segment of the community, but also be sensitive to those who are upset and turned off.
Again, as I said, this is real. It's definitely when I said that I had in mind when we started Mishpacha to have it at least in the English edition pictures of women, I thought we thought about a Family First. And again, the reaction we got was, if in the print magazine, yes, it's not halachically, and that's why it was important for me to share with you what the Gdoila Poskim told us when we asked the question about Hilokim. It's not an halachic issue. On the other hand, as I said, we will lose some of the people that we want to have an influence of, on their lives, meaning some of our readership will feel uncomfortable with the publication. But we feel that we have to do something, and I'm telling you, we invested hundreds of thousands of dollars on the website, and one of the main reasons, wasn't a business, was because we felt that Mishpacha as a brand must show that they have a different approach to dealing with pictures of women. So we are continuing, both in Hebrew and in English, to promote the digital version of Mishpacha, showing that it's not something that it's eliminating the brand. We are starting in Hebrew. Now we have a newsletter. It's like a family first in emails, goes to women. We have over 10,000 subscribers, which includes images and pictures of women in a very modest way. Interestingly enough, we did a survey, and some of the women who are getting this newsletter are not allowing Mishpacha publication to go into their home. So this is really in line with your suggestion, meaning they feel that Mishpacha is too much open-minded, but the mother or the consumer feel comfortable enough that they can get such something for them. So it's a very fine line. I agree with you. It's a fine line. I think we have to demonstrate that we are taking seriously this issue. I hope to see a change over the next years. I believe that the balance between digital and the publication is a good balance. Again, as long as it's done.
Family first. That's the best balance. Let family first have pictures of women. Again, we don't want to harp on this, but essentially, Mishpacha is more concerned to maintain its readership on the right than it is to maintain and make happy the readership of the more open segment of the community.
Because the social around, yeah.
No, you want to have everybody, and I think that's beautiful, but the social activism in one direction is at the expense of activism in the other, and that's a decision. You know, I've told people who are upset about it, vote with your feet, don't subscribe, don't read it, because in the end of the day, you know, that's what influences change. But I think the evidence of people enjoying it so much is that they want to have their mishpacha and eat it too. They want to be able to read it and subscribe to it even as they're upset. So, you know, let's move on from this. I will say that personally, and I think I speak on behalf of the rabbis here, we disagree with the policy. We think it's a mistake. It's a miscalculation. And it has a negative impact. But what I would urge others to think about is not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. That as a whole, mishpacha deserves that credit for the social activism. It deserves the credit for the change in the Haredi community. It deserves credit for boldly embracing a level of diversity, which has not come without a cost. And maybe you want to address that. What was it like to be the target of criticism from segments of the Haredi community for the fact that you were willing to feature Svardim, Hasidim, Litvisha, Yeshiva University, Modern Orthodox, Dati Leumi? What about the criticism that comes from that direction and the bold move you've shown by doing that nonetheless?
So I think this is where I feel comfortable and even proud to get criticized by some people. And as I mentioned to you in our previous call, I think over the time, some of the criticism about Mishpacha was exactly this point. People say, listen, you don't have the right Hashkafa. Right Hashkafa means my own Hashkafa for everybody. His own Hashkafa is the right Hashkafa. So how dare you to have on one week the Satmar Rebbe on the cover, and the other week you can have Rav Schefter, as you mentioned. In Israel, it was Rav Ovadia Yosef. And you will be surprised that till Mishpacha interviewed the first time Rav Ovadia, and even after that, we did the cover story with Rav Ovadia. We had three exclusive interviews with Rav Ovadia over his life. He was never featured in the Haredi publications in Israel. So yes, we were criticized that Mishpacha, the argument was, you are a business. All you care about is to sell more publications. You don't care about the right Hashkafa. And I was very proud to be under this attack and criticism, because this is what made Mishpacha is so unique. So yes, our approach and our philosophy is that we as a Torah publication should respect every Torah leader, whether he is Litvish or Sfaradi or Yeshiva University or Mordechai Eliyahu, whoever. And as I said, it happened also to be a very successful formula for the business as well, meaning it wasn't done for a business motivation. But at the end of the day, this is something nice about the Haredi society. Yes, It's very segregated. Everyone cares about his own community, and he wants to see his Rebbe and only his Rebbe as a voice. But at the end of the day, people are making their choices. And the fact that Mishpacha became the leading publication, both in Israel and in America, shows that at the end of the day, even the Haredi, the most extreme Haredi people, appreciate a publication who can bring a different voice and a different kind of discussion into the community. So, yes, we had criticism. Sometimes people even went to Rabbanim and showed them, you know, see what Mishpacha did. They gave Rav Ovadia, and Rav Ovadia now made a Psak Halacha that is against the mainstream. And I'm so happy that we're lucky to have this Siyata Dishmaya to try to bring a different kind of discussion into the community. And at the end of the day, as I said, over the years, And including today, Mishpacha is increasing dramatically year after year because people feel that Mishpacha is bringing into the Haredi society something different that they're so missing.
Well, I remember there was another Haredi magazine in America that is no longer, which I think is very instructive. When Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, passed away, it couldn't ignore it, but it didn't give him the titles or the respect. In some ways, it was more insulting what they wrote than had they left it out. And again, I think that's refreshing. And I think you and Mishpacha deserve credit for not bringing that approach. I'm proud on a regular basis, almost weekly, when there are references to the width and breadth of the Orthodox world. I just want to put on the screen that one of your contributors, Alex Flexer, who writes regularly for Mishpacha, writes, who's listening, "I'm willing to have my op-ed column without my headshot, because I will not sacrifice my voice for my face," which is a perspective from a woman contributor. Mm-hmm. She does follow it up by saying, "I wait for the day when I can have both." So she does want to have both. It is a complicated topic, but people should, I think, try to be open to understanding and not only being understood, even if they, Alexandra, I apologize, even if they disagree in the end, but to understand and to be understood. But we have so much more to talk to you about. I know everybody has a question.
Yeah, no, first of all, thank you so much. And that was a really important conversation. I'm glad we had it and we gave, and I thank you for your honesty, really, and your openness and your candor. I want to pivot a little bit to your think tank, the Haredi Institute for Public Affairs. And you referenced several times that you view Mishpacha as a vehicle for social change to address some of the challenges in the Haredi community. I was wondering if you can elaborate upon that a little bit and discuss what you view as those challenges in the Haredi community, and what are some of the changes that you see in the Haredi community, specifically for a listenership and a viewership that might not be as aware or in tune with some of the nuances of the Haredi community and see it most in stereotypical terms. What are some of the challenges and what are some of the changes that you're seeing that might not be visible to the public eye?
Thank you so much for allowing me to share with you too. So back almost three decades when I was in Mishpacha, my main focus as a publisher was really to elevate the society, Haredi society, address social issues in the Haredi society. And we felt this is our mission, this is our goal. In 2010, more or less, we felt that the tension between the Haredi and the non-Haredi society, that was a little bit before the days of Lapid, when Lapid later was elected, we felt that the tension is becoming something that we have to do something about it. We tried to do something about it in the publication. We devoted, in the Hebrew publication, we devoted an entire supplement to discuss the economic challenges of the Haredi participant in the work field, to see what the actual picture, not just the mythology, what really what's happening and what are the obstacles and the challenges. And we were attacked very much by the establishment that we are trying to push the envelope. We are trying to encourage people to leave yeshivas and to go to work and etc. And I felt that we have to do something about it. And the main, if you ask me what's the main challenge, I think the Haredi society, which I love and I feel so much connected and lucky to be part of this society, chose a strategy that has some big price. The strategy was that in order to preserve the Haredi lifestyle and the Torah lifestyle, they understood that with these challenges, we have to create kind of segregation and disconnection from the entire society, which started by, you know, for sure having our own schools, But slowly, slowly, it's became almost every aspect in life. We are living in a separate neighborhoods. We are reading separate publications without pictures of women. We are having our own businesses. Everything is separated. And I think that was a strategy that at the end of the day even worked, meaning the fact that the Haredi society is growing so dramatically, it's against any chance. Nobody believed in my father's life when he was a child that there is a chance that the Haredi society will survive, and for sure that it became. Today we're talking about 12% of the Israeli population are Haredi, 12%. But more importantly, almost every fourth child in the Jewish schools in the first grade in this school year is a Haredi boy. Every fourth child, meaning 25% of the kids in the Jewish schools in Israel today are Haredi. You don't have to be a genius to imagine what's the ramification of this in 20, 30 years from now. Now the forecast in 2065 is that almost 35 or 32% of the population is going to be Haredi. So you have to understand that this is a challenge that, yes, on one hand, Haredi society chose to live and to focus only on their own, but it's created some concern by the rest of the society. And I felt that someone who lives in the society and appreciates so much what the Haredi society have to contribute to the society, that we need someone to bridge and to try to, A, to bring the real facts and the real challenges into the public discourse, to try to see how we can benefit from the Haredi society, and not just in terms how we can make more Haredi men to go to work. This is not our job. You know, everyone have to make their own decision, and for sure we, as a Haredi society, are admiring and appreciating and doing whatever we can to see more people sitting and learning. But the issue is that we as a Haredi society also have to come with our own answers and say, okay, this is our lifestyle, this is our values, this is how we are raising the families, but we are not looking into the big challenges of Israel as a whole. So this is where I felt we have to do something. I felt that as a publication, we are very limited, and there is a need to create a real vehicle to help, A, the state of Israel, and B, the Haredi society, to create some kind of a partnership that they can benefit from each other. So it was the days that my father passed away. It was 8 years ago. And I felt I want to do something to continue his heritage. He was a very, as I mentioned, he was someone who was involved in starting, working for building Haredi neighborhoods and building yeshivas. He was the one who started to make Har Nof to become Haredi. Originally, the municipality of Jerusalem planned it's going to be a secular neighborhood. And he decided he needs to be a Haredi. And his very creative way of working and activism, he changed it and make it to became a Haredi neighborhood.
Did he put Angel's Bakery there? Is he responsible for
it? No, but seriously, he decided that he has to become Haredi. And the way he did it, by the way, was that he opened a small office in the city and asked people to register that they want to buy homes. He got 150 people registered. He went to a few constructors and said, listen, I have 150 people wants to buy by you. Would you be willing to sell? I said, for sure. And then he went to a secular publication and told them, listen, you know, Haredim are going to take over Har Nof. He was so happy to write it. And the next week, on the main headline was Haredim are taking over. And that's exactly what he wanted to happen. So then secular people start to feel uncomfortable, and the rest was history. So he was involved with Kids at Risk. He took kids from street and brought home. He was involved with Agunos. He was involved in yeshivas. And I felt I want to continue to do something in his heritage. So I started the Family Foundation. And since then, this is today, I'm mainly focusing on my public activity and the foundation. I'm trying not to bother my business managers and focusing mainly on the charity. And I felt that the key, what's needed, you're asking what's really needed. There is two things that I feel needs to be changed. A, the decision makers have to really understand better and having the data and understanding about the Haredi society and to see where there is a real potential of engagement between the societies. I'll give you just one example. We are working now over 2 years with the leading Haredi seminaries together with the high-tech industry in Israel to create high-level programs how to train Haredi women to become top programmers and engineers in the industry, including the defense industry. This is really a game changer that till today, they look at the Haredi, we said, are you Haredi? So we'll give you some low-level courses. We brought together the key leading high-tech managers, including the Israel Air Force industry and the 8200 unit and Mellanox and others, together with Rabbanim, together with the leading principals of the seminaries, and we built a high-level academic plan that's going to be taught in the high-tech. And the issue is not how we can help to create more jobs for Haredim in the high-tech. Our perspective is how the Haredi society can contribute to the security of Israel and to the strength of the Israeli economy by bringing their talent and their capacity into this field. So this is the main, if you ask me, the main vision is A, to create a database and a policy institute who can work with the government. Today, our CEO was a senior people in the prime minister office, who secular guy, who left the office just to join our vision. We are working in issues of employment, housing, kids at risk, every aspect of life. You know, we're talking today about big challenges. One of the challenges I want to share with you, and maybe we're close to the end, what we learned over the COVID is that there is a big mistrust between the Haredi society and the government. And we saw it, I think, also in America, you were facing this kind of the challenge, and ask ourselves, what can we do about it? So we were very much involved with the home front and the Malal to provide them with data and different kind of information that can help to make a better decisions. But the main concern was, what can we do to try to create a better engagement and a sense of mamlachtiyut, a sense of connection between the Haredim and the non-Haredim? And now one of our leading projects that headed by Emmy Palmo, she was the former CEO of the Justice Ministry, again, a secular lady. She's today sitting by Facebook board, like very prominent lady, that we are working on a plan how to integrate strategically a significant amount of Haredim into the public sector. We believe that if around the table in every governmental office, we will have a real representative, not a Skonim, which I have nothing against a Skonim, but not a Skonim. Experts, people in the health ministry, the defense ministry, and the Ministry of Finance, we will have more Haredim. So A, the Haredi voice will be heard, meaning the decision makers will understand better the Haredi nuances and culture, and etc. And B, Haredim will start to feel that they are part of the story, and it won't be anymore us and them. It will be us as part of the state of Israel, and this is our big vision.
Do you get any pushback from Gedolim about the increased exposure, certainly from women in the Haredi world, to the workplace and the high-tech industries?
Absolutely not. The opposite. That's what I'm saying. We got 15 endorsement letters for this high-tech project, including from Professor Zeifman, the former president of the Weizmann Institute, and including of the Moeses Gdoile HaToiro, that from Degel HaTorah, that they have their own representatives sitting around the steering committee. Everything is done together with them. We are doing it with the guidance of the Rabbonim on one hand, but bringing the Rabbonim also the needs from the industry and saying, listen, if you really want women to support their husband to sit and learn, they have to be trained and they have to learn in a much higher level. And this is the beauty of the way we are working. We have secular and from people. Yitzhak Pindrus was the former CEO. Today is a Knesset member from the Degel HaTorah. And Roy Cohen, today a secular guy, came from the prime minister office working Haredim and Al-Haredim together to try to bring a better future for the state of Israel.
I want to encourage people, if you want to learn more about this institute, you could go to machon.org or Google the Haredi Institute for Public Affairs. I spent some time on that website, Ellie, and it's fascinating. Some of the studies and research, the data, so they're informed decisions. It's not anecdotal, it's not speculative, but you're trying to tackle understanding the Haredi community from a scientific perspective, which is really new. And I think that's something which is wonderful. I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank you for your willingness for us to push back a little bit. I know some of these topics are uncomfortable, but I guess you've made a career out of being willing to take on the uncomfortable in order to advance the things that you think are important. And again, while we may disagree with a particular policy, and it's not insignificant for those that are offended by it, I think it's important to see the bigger picture and the wonderful good and the difference it's making. And I want to thank you for waking up so early in the morning.
You
were extraordinarily articulate.
Yeah.
For somebody who taught himself English and to be able to speak so well at 4 o'clock in the morning, thank you so much. I hope we'll be able to continue this conversation.
Thank you.
I hope we can continue online and offline. And we thank you so much for being with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much. Bye.
Take care. Fascinating conversation.
First of all, I was laughing when he said,
yeah, go ahead.
I laughing said, you know, some people subscribe to Mishpach and some people get it from friends. So we happen to get like a delivery every 3 months of a stack, yay high, of Mishpach magazines. And it's like my kids are like vultures on it. You know, each one wants to get different parts of the magazine and obviously contributes a lot to our Shabbases.
Yeah, Mishpach is the evidence is how many people who are upset or opposed to that policy continue to get it. And I'll sometimes say to them, because, you know, I share that frustration with the policy. I think it's wrong, but vote with your feet. And the reason that they continue to maintain it is because the people who oppose it continue to buy it or read it or subscribe to it or borrow it from their friend. But I think it's important to see the bigger good and to hear him. He's a wonderful person. He's sophisticated. He's smart. He's self-taught. He's successful. And he really, I think, has a bigger picture good in mind. I think he's pained by the pain that policy causes others. Some will say he's not pained enough to change it. But nevertheless, it is something which at least is complicated. As we're winding down, we've got a few more topics and a few more minutes, but I do want to mention again, Shira Gabriella and her amazing artwork. Check her out on Instagram or check out her website. Really fantastic stuff. And a special thank you to Seth and Esther for that sponsorship. Should we give the answer away? How far back our family goes? Does anybody know?
Go for it.
Rabbi,
go for it.
Do you know?
Stream it.
I think it's where it's Rabbi Prell's father.
My great grandparents, Rabbi Gedalia Aboff and Elizabeth, and my great grandfather Chazen Nolman in Newark, both knew Shira Gabriella's great grandparents, Rabbi Elazar Meir Prell and Freda Prell, and the year that they began their relationship was 1917. Okay. So our families go back more than 100 years of friendship. So I guess I win the artwork. The alternative that Seth in real time is texting me is, if anyone is still listening from Boca who remembers the original Running Rebs team, who was on the original team when the Kollel rabbis played community members? Who was on the Running Rebs team to be able to qualify for 50% off on the second piece of artwork? Check it out. Support Shira Gabriella. It's not a chesed. The artwork is beautiful. Makes for an amazing Hanukkah present. It's really going to adorn your home. You're going to love it. It's a great gift for someone else. Rabbi Brody, you didn't get a chance to ask a question, and I apologize for that.
That's okay. I know
it was
running late.
What was on your mind? What would you have wanted?
Talk to him about the Chevron Yeshiva. You mentioned five generations. So I just found this picture. I have it on my phone because I scanned 10,000 pictures. And this actually just came back. Yeah, that's the Rosh Hashiva. That's for Simcha Zissel Brody, right? So I wanted to know. I've never met someone that knew him. You know, supposedly he was one of the great Rosh Hashivas.
Are you in that picture with him?
Yeah, that's me. That's me.
So you knew him, but I understand.
No, but I knew him. Put it this way. Let me explain to you. He spoke about his broken English. When I went to go meet the Rosh Hashiva, someone said I was related. We spell our names the same way, Broida, right?
Right.
So we sat down in his study. It's a big study. Chevron Yeshiva is a massive campus. You know, they say it's like one of the exclusive types of yeshivas in Israel. And he says, do you want to speak in Hebrew or English? So I look at him. I said, oh, no, what do I do here? So I said, I say Hebrew. I guess Hebrew, you know. I'm a second year guy now. So he puts his hand on my knee and he says, we'll talk in English.
He understood. We'll have to have him back on. We can ask him that question and others. I think it was a really fascinating conversation. I think people should be open-minded. It doesn't mean they'll be convinced or have to agree, but I think that there is an interesting phenomenon which is going on and something that's worth thinking about and talking about more. I want to acknowledge, and really deserves maybe to be elaborated on in a separate episode, but our sponsor, Seth Grossman, has done something extraordinary. You know, Seth is a great person with a big heart. You know, for some people, and sometimes he makes it hard to see, but he's got a big heart and we love him, we know it. Seth did something. You know, at the beginning of Corona, we featured on our show and in our weekly. And by the way, I also didn't want Ellie to feel bad that the BRS Weekly has 300,000 people who get it.
It's close. It's right behind Mishpacha.
It's right behind. It's Mishpacha, and right underneath it is the Boker Ton Synagogue weekly magazine that we put out, right. The Bulletin.
Can you imagine? Think about how much work we put into the weekly. Can you imagine what goes into publishing Mishpacha? I mean, it must be an incredible operation.
Right, right. So I did want to say this about Seth. Towards the beginning of Corona, Seth did something. You know, we featured heroes, obviously the people on the front lines, doctors, those who are risking themselves, members of the Chevra Kadisha, Chesed. There are all kinds of people, our security, volunteer security, all kinds of people were doing great stuff. Seth Grossman, who I've never met somebody, maybe Shimmy comes in a close second, but I don't think I've met anyone who has as committed to not miss Minyan. He's like nuts about never missing a Minyan. So even when we were shut down here in America, in Israel, Seth and Esther, our sponsors, live in Ramat Beit Shemesh, in Ramat Shiloh, and Seth doesn't miss a minyan. So there were minyan on him and on porches and in backyards and elsewhere. Seth wasn't missing a minyan. He put a message out there and he said, anyone who's saying Kaddish, anywhere in the world, where the world, the minyanim, the shuls are all shut down, I'll say Kaddish for you. And over the course of Corona, what are we, 8-9 months in? He has said Kaddish for more than 160 people, 3 times a day, never missing minyan, to ensure that 160 people who are in mourning will not miss a Kaddish. Wow. And I think that's something extraordinary. It deserves acknowledgement and credit. Amazing. Way to go, Seth.
Hats off to you.
You are our hero tonight. Hats off to you for never missing. That is something which is exceptional. We also have a shame on you, but we're running out of time, so we're not going to do a shame on you tonight. I just complimented him about the minyanim.
I love it. This is great.
We heard you in the background.
I know.
Yeah, it's okay. Shh, don't forget. By the way,
we apparently have four co-hosts right now.
It's on the record, and it'll be Seth's favorite part of the night, is that a certain person whispered, don't forget to compliment Seth.
Oh, yeah.
If he could clip that and hang
feature story in Mishpacha magazine next week.
Yeah. It's he did a great job, and Seth deserves a lot of credit. So we had a lot of other topics to talk about tonight. We had a shame on you. Whether it's the New York Times, who have basically canceled the holiday of Hanukkah with that absurd article, or whether it is, other outrageous things that have happened online, a group who have Jewish in their name, Jewish Voice for Peace. Hold on one second. I can't help myself. I have to do this. Hold on. Before I call them out. Hold on.
What did they do?
You just wanted
Shame
to do that.
You. There's a group, Jewish Voice for Peace, and they posted on their Twitter feed today, Jewish Voice for Peace. They wrote, today is the 33rd anniversary of the First Intifada, a series of mass protests against Israeli settler colonialism and occupation. Two of those protests are on this 2003 poster, blah, blah, blah. Where there is oppression, may there thrive resistance. This is a group with Jewish in the name who refer to the Intifada as a series of protests against Israel settler colonialism, and they call for, where there's oppression, may there thrive resistance. Jewish Voice of Peace, shame on you.
Yeah,
hats off to you, Seth Grossman, and shame on you, Jewish Voice for
Peace. All right, Jews for Jesus also have the word Jew in there.
Jewish. Just because you're Jewish in your name does not mean you're authentically Jewish.
Right.
Last topic, and we'll call it a night. We're already over time. We had a great conversation with Ellie. Thank you so much. The owner, publisher, Mishpacha, the founder of the Haredi Institute for Public Affairs.
Wow.
And really a conversation that we really need to continue. The last topic I was going to bring up, what's the deal with WhatsApp voice notes? WhatsApp voice notes. First of all, it used to be that Americans all type texts, and you get the long voice notes from people in Israel. Israelis love WhatsApp voice notes. They love it. And you know, the beauty of a text is you can be in the middle of something else and still read the text.
Right.
But a voice note, you gotta be in a place.
Yeah, you know what it's called? It's called, I don't really want to talk to you, but yeah, I need to get a message to you and I'm too lazy to text it. So I'm going to use a voice note, which is basically the lazy man's way of talking to you.
It's an interesting phenomenon because we all engage it too. And I'm not calling ourselves out, but have you ever been in like a 20-minute long leaving one another voice notes? And then at some point you say to yourself,
We're just having a phone conversation.
Yeah, by the way, usually it's with my wife. And at some point she comes in, she's like, you know, I'm in the other room. You could have just come in and spoken to me.
The fascinating part about the voice note conversations that go back and forth is maybe it developed because we have an inability to actually listen to one another and allow the other to finish their thought. So what a voice note conversation essentially is, are two people in conversation with an inability to interrupt one another. and an obligation to hear the other person out.
Now, nah. I'll give the benefit of the doubt.
Sometimes you don't make it till the end of the voice note, let's just say.
Most of the time, but I'll give the benefit of the doubt. It's a convenient way, right? Because if you and I are having a conversation, you and I both need to be present at the same time. If I leave you a voice note, I'm essentially saying I need to tell you something. It was on my mind. I don't want to bother you. You can listen to it now. You can listen to it in 5 minutes. And when you get back to me in 5 minutes, there's no guarantee that I need to be available then either. So it's a convenient way of having a conversation where each of us can be autonomous.
Let's have some rules. Here are my rules. Number one, if the voice notes are going to go back and forth more than a couple times, why don't we just talk like normal human beings?
Correct.
Number two,
can't be more than a minute.
Gotta be
more than a minute.
I'll give a minute and a half, but after a minute and a half, you lose.
Let me ask you a question. When's the last time you've listened to a voice note longer than a minute? The whole thing, the full minute and a half.
Depends who leaves the voice note. Some of the people for sure leave me voice notes right now about tonight. I will not be listening to. No, I'm just joking. I listen to everybody and I value all the input and I welcome it. I'm eager to hear it. But yeah, there's got to be a cap on the voice note. There's got to be a cap. Some people leave 3-4 minute voice notes.
That's the same thing with the text.
Leave that on a machine.
I see paragraph text. I can't read them.
That's like an email you get. How many scrolls will you give it that if the email's still going on, you're not reading it?
Yeah.
Right? Like if you give it,
if you have to scroll by definition,
and it's still going
on,
too much. Two screens worth, I'll read.
If we know someone,
third screen worth.
We all know someone.
We know someone who sends very long emails that we've been known to sometimes not make it through the entire.
Long emails may qualify as doctoral dissertations. Some of them can be submitted for a thesis, a master's thesis.
Yeah, anyway. But you know what? I'm just thinking, you know, with, you know, you guys were doing the voice notes today. I was texting the group, the bigger group, but I did it through the voice recognition and it auto-corrected or it did something, which I didn't say that word.
Yes, it did. But you know, those are the other things, by the way. You ever have that? You keep writing and the other person leaves a voice note to which you write, to which they leave a voice note. And now you're having like two modes.
You don't even know where you are languages. Anymore. Right.
Anyway, it's all fascinating. These are the musings of three rabbis.
And I got one more. I got one more here. Google came out with their top trending search queries for 2020. Now, I'm not interested in what those are, but this is they're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Google year in search, which means the first time was in 2001. What were the most top searched items in 2001? Three items given to me. 2001.
2001?
2001. Yeah. What do you think were the top searched
9/11.
Items on Google? Osama bin Laden's one.
Yeah.
9/11. Osama bin Laden's number one. You got two more. You'll never get them. Number two is
that .com bubble crash.
Eminem. Anyone remember him? Eminem.
The candy?
Not the gamut. And number three is Nostradamus. Those were the three top search items in the year 2001. And what do you think the top search items were for this year?
Coronavirus.
Kobe Bryant and election results.
I know the third. No. And behind the Bima.
That was number four.
And behind the Bima. All right. A huge thank you to Eli Pelli. Thank you so much for coming on. What a great conversation, important conversation. And, you know, just to be clear, I don't get money from Mishpacha. I'm not on the payroll there. So any positive things, it's because I believe it. And also that gives credibility to give the pushback. So it was a great conversation. We're grateful.
And most importantly, happy birthday.
For making the connection.
Exactly.
And thank you. We should all celebrate birthdays and years and simchas. And especially after this pandemic and after people have experienced a lot of crisis and loss, every opportunity to be happy for a simcha, for a l'chaim to life. We're all so grateful for that. So until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, stay holy. Rabbis, thank you. A lichtige Chanukah, a freilige Chanukah. Should be a light Chanukah.
We'll be lighting next week here.
All the darkness in the world. Let's light the world on fire. Let's bring a lot of light to this world and light the world on fire.
Be the light post.
Lichtige Chanukah and a great Shabbos and a gemet to all.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Bima. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next week for another peek behind the Bima.